Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I think the SNP have disappeared down a kind of wormhole of woke.
Four.
I'm rather cheerful this week. We've seen the downfall of a couple of sort of notorious idiots, haven't we, really?
Three.
What do the Irish normally do when there's a problem? They blame the British.
Two.
Lots of listeners getting in touch, very excited, asking, you know, can they come and sit on Liam's knee? I've said no, that's my place.
One.
Welcome once again to Planet Normal, the Telegraph podcast, Alison Pearson.
Hello.
And me, Liam Halligan. Election fever's upon us, co-pilot, with votes taking place today, Thursday, as this episode of Planet Normal leaves the launch pad. The electoral battle's on across 107 local authorities in England, with contests also taking place for Mayor of London, London Assembly seats, and 10 mayorships beyond the capital. We've got a by-election in Blackpool South, after a former Tory MP resigned, and voters across England and Wales are electing 37 police and crime commissioners. There are no elections in Scotland or Northern Ireland, but we will be discussing both those parts of the UK on today's Planet Normal. And with voting now underway, we have to be careful, don't we, co-pilot, not to breach electoral rules imposed on journalists by commenting on individual candidates. But we will be talking about the resignation of Scottish First Minister Hamza Yousaf, who lasted little more than a year after the SNP imploded, not just amidst claims of serious financial mismanagement, but also because it's fallen out with the Scottish Greens, whose votes the SNP needed to maintain their Hollywood majority. We'll be talking too about growing tensions between the UK, particularly Northern Ireland, and the Irish Republic, as the two countries row over who should be responsible for escalating numbers of asylum seekers. Plus, there are growing concerns about AstraZeneca's anti-COVID vaccine, Alison, amidst mounting evidence, including admissions from the pharmaceutical giant itself, that a small but significant number of vaccine recipients have endured permanent and in some cases rather serious damage to their health. But before all that, Alison, let's tell listeners again about our upcoming Planet Normal event on Wednesday, the 29th of May at Cadogan Hall in London, where we'll be recording our drumroll, wait for it, 200th anniversary of Planet Normal in front of a live audience. How exciting. And Telegraph subscribers who'd like to join us on the night can buy tickets via the Telegraph website, link in the show notes to this episode. Have you bought your new frock yet?
I'm not sure I can afford a ticket. I mean, no, apparently I come anyway, and we've had lots of feedback, lots of listeners getting in touch, very excited, asking, you know, can they come and sit on Liam's knee? I've said no, that's my place.
Yeah, because you want your choice of knees, so you won't even let someone sit on the other one. And of course, we've got the brilliant Lionel Shriver, novelist extraordinaire, very astute social commentator, friend of Planet Normal, who actually appeared at our 100th episode celebration as well.
You know, I think Lionel is one of the best talkers, actually, of our age. I could listen to her the whole time. She's written a fantastic new novel about manias, you know, the stuff that we talk about the whole time, trans, everything else. I think in this novel, people aren't allowed to be cleverer than anyone else, but she is one of the smartest and funniest women. So we're going to have a great time and we're going to have some drinks with listeners. So if you haven't booked your ticket, please come along, bring friends and family. We've got young and old. I was just going to say sane and insane, but that's me covered, isn't it, really? That's us.
Oi!
Jury's still out on which one. We have been getting a lot of emails from listeners. I'm trying not to take it personally, addressing my magnificent rants. I don't mind. I thought they were eloquent diatribes is more what I'm aiming for, really.
Just like Lionel Shriver, as we say in the broadcasting business, Alison, you give good chat.
Oh.
And I agree with you. I do think, well, not only that your many of your rants are actually fact-strewn flights of journalistic integrity, but I also am a huge admirer of Lionel Shriver. And I still kind of pinch myself that one of the really great novelists of our age, let's be clear, is such a fan of Planet Normal and has taken such an interest in our podcast over the last 4 years. And you've also written very beautifully and generously, if I may say so, about Planet Normal in The Telegraph this week. Again, we'll put the link to that little article about our podcast in the show notes to this episode. But let's move on to Scotland, where there aren't elections happening today, Thursday, of course, but there is a tsunami of politics going on.
Oh, goodness me. Yes, I'm rather cheerful this week. We've seen the downfall of a couple of sort of notorious idiots, haven't we, really? We've got to take our victories where we can, Halligan. Hamza Youssef, Scotland's first minister, resigned, a slightly tearful, self-congratulatory resignation speech. You know, it was one of those gives with one hand, takes with the other. And he said that every issue seems to degenerate into a toxic culture war. I mean, if anyone was responsible for toxic culture wars, it's been Hamza Youssef. Yeah, it's been absolutely fascinating, Liam, because I think that what we're seeing is these devolved countries, both Scotland and my own Wales, they've become sort of fiefdoms of the progressive left. And they are absolutely splenetic about the populist right. But the chickens are very much coming home to roost now in all these countries which have supported trans ideology, extreme net zero, and other left-wing politics. And what I wrote about in my column this week is that listeners will probably know that the runner-up to Hamza Youssef in the SNP leadership contest was a very sensible and clever woman called Kate Forbes. Now, Kate is a Christian. She's a member of the Free Church of Scotland. She holds quite strong Christian views, which is perfectly permissible in politics. And she has said that although she opposes abortion and certain other things, she absolutely doesn't let that influence her voting. She has a right to hold those views and not enforce them in office. But this is my question for you, Liam. So Kate Forbes is being damned in the media, in our mainstream media, as socially conservative because she's a Christian. But Hamza Youssef is a Muslim. And Muslims, as we know, Islam is a very socially conservative religion. But it wasn't a huge problem when it was a man, a Muslim, being the first minister. But apparently everyone would have a huge problem with a Christian woman leading Scotland, even though I should say that Kate Forbes is hugely popular with normal Scottish people, with normal SNP members. So I think what we're seeing really is this great battle now where the progressive left, people like Leo Varadkar will come onto Ireland, Nicola Sturgeon, Hamza Youssef, the progressive left is now having to be confronted with the consequences of its policies. And the only answer they have now is to shout down people like us. Apparently, we are populists who are far right, but we never, ever see the nutcases like the Scottish Greens. You know, we'll talk about them in a bit, but they are far left. But we always hear people called far right, socially conservative. You never hear the other side described as far left.
I think there's a lot in that, Alison. I think the SNP have disappeared down a kind of wormhole of woke, an ill-advised bid, I would say, to attract younger voters. And not that we don't want young people to vote and be engaged in politics, of course, but just to assume that, you know, the panoply of younger voters are by definition in favour of a lot of the kind of issues promoted by the Greens. Politics and so on. And the SNP have relied on the Greens over recent years for their majority in Holyrood. And the Greens abandoned the SNP because they felt the SNP under Hamza Youssef in Scotland, when they finally realised and acknowledged that a lot of what they were saying on these issues was actually not in step at all with the bulk of the electorate, when they finally realised that extreme net zero policies and, you know, Scotland is the oil and gas capital of Europe. Hundreds of thousands of people are employed in Scotland and indeed across the UK by our oil and gas complex, not least in and around Aberdeen. So the SNP was woefully out of touch with a lot of mainstream Scottish opinion, I would say, even if it felt it was really in touch with trendy metropolitan opinion among the media and political classes. So Hamza Youssef has left. He did last longer than Liz Truss. He lasted just over a year. And all this will, of course, play absolutely into the Labour Party's hands. Labour cannot form a majority at Westminster unless they do well in Scotland. You know, when Blair won his 179-seat majority, Labour dominated Scotland, and indeed Scottish MPs dominated New Labour, not least Gordon Brown, Alistair Darling, you know, very, very influential people. Donald Jurg, of course, was the First Minister of Scotland under the Labour Party. So what's going on in Scotland, it does have really seismic importance, not just because I think this retreat away from more extreme kind of identity politics will echo across the rest of the UK. And I do think the dial is now moving. And I do think the cash report was hugely important in that movement. Also, I think you'll have a situation where Scotland itself is going to play a key role in determining the extent of the majority that Keir Starmer gets. And in Anas Sarwar, Scottish Labour Party, they actually have quite a talented and credible leader, I would say.
So as I said, I think these claims of diversity, protected characteristics can be very interesting, Liam. We're recording on Wednesday afternoon. We'll see whether Kate Forbes is actually going to run and defy all these people in her own party, the Boys Club, who want to install Sturgeon's former deputy leader as the leader. And I have to say, Liam, this is actually very interesting. So for a couple of years on Planet Normal, we've had listeners in Scotland telling us, you wait until the lid is lifted off on what went on during Sturgeon's tenure. And they said the whole terrible house of cards will come tumbling down. And I think the British media has had a real kid gloves, hands-off approach to criticising the Scottish government and the Welsh government because they are left-wing governments. I don't think they're normal left-wing governments. I think in some cases they are Marxist policies that they're pursuing. And because there was a kind of family hold-back approach to Nicola Sturgeon, she was lionised by the London media. And many people were telling us, you know, there were very serious question marks over many things that were going on in the SNP. And I think we have seen a totally different approach to coverage of the SNP to, say, the, you know, the dreaded Tories. As you know, Liam, I'm not the biggest fan at the moment of the Conservative Party, but nevertheless.
Didn't notice it myself, actually. You rarely mention it, Alison.
I rarely know, I don't. You know, I just think there is the total double standard. Why did Sturgeon get away with for so long? And in fact, we will remember that joyously, she was brought down over gender identity nonsense, wasn't she? They were trying to push through this self-ID bill in Scotland. And it coincided brilliantly with a male rapist who announced that he was a she and was pictured gloriously in the famous pink Lycra leggings with ample evidence at the front that he was very much not a she. So she was hoist by the pink Lycra leggings. And we've seen that as well. Like we said, the completely nuts Scottish Greens co-leadership, who one of them is Canadian. No surprises there, because Canada has become the world capital of wokery. What did someone say to us, Liam? Are they... They're non-binary, aren't they? The two Scottish Greens are the man and woman, although possibly we're not supposed to call them that anymore, but they are non-binary. And as you said, the reason they had this big bust up with Youssef was because they didn't want NHS Scotland to follow NHS England's lead and ban puberty blockers, following on from the devastating conclusions in the Hillary Cass review. So it's going to be very interesting, isn't it, to see how this pans out in the next few days. And as you say, Labour looking set very fair to recover some of its huge, huge stock in Scotland.
Let's move on because time is pressing. Let's talk about Ireland, because there's been an explosion, hasn't there, of tension between the UK government and the Irish Republic government. We've got a new Taoiseach, Simon Harris, who's from the same party as Leo Varadkar, Fine Gael, which is traditionally the least nationalist party. Fianna Fáil, they were on the other side in the Irish Civil War. They seem to be more nationalist. Both the main parties in Ireland now have Sinn Féin breathing down their neck. Sinn Féin, of course, has the First Minister in Northern Ireland for the first time, and Sinn Féin are also set fair to prevail at Irish elections too. That is in the Republic of Ireland. But real tension now, Alison, with Irish politicians blaming Britain's Rwanda policy for scaring asylum seekers / economic migrants in the UK. So they then cross the Irish Sea to Northern Ireland and then cross the land border into the Republic of Ireland, of course, which puts them out of the UK and in the EU.
I think that's complete nonsense. I think that that is an excuse that they've come up with to cover up their absolutely out of control immigration policy. I'm sure there are a handful of illegal migrants who have made that journey and ended up in the Republic of Ireland. But looking up the figures, there were 15,000 migrants arrived last year. I'm sure hardly any of those knew anything about the Rwanda plan. So this is basically Ireland desperately now covering her backside. We had Leo Varadkar, another of these posturing progressives, a la Sturgeon, you know, wanted to be Mr. Magnanimous with his mates in the EU, throw open the doors, everybody come, like Angela Merkel inviting a million Syrians to come in. And that's what's happened, Liam, is that Ireland is a small, homogenous country, as I don't have to tell you that. People increasingly up in arms, increasing social tension, asylum centres being set on fire, streets full of tents. Ireland has a terrible housing crisis, can't house its own people. So a highly combustible situation. And I have to say, I know there are very serious aspects to it, but I thought it was absolutely hilarious. So about 2 weeks ago, Ireland's High Court designated the United Kingdom not a safe country to return migrants to, right? So that was them, moral high ground, high horsing, let's call the Brits despicable because of the Rwanda plan. So the UK was not a safe country to return migrants to. But now suddenly they've got this absolutely vast, dangerous migrant crisis. And suddenly the UK is very much a safe place to return migrants to. So massive screeching U-turn. And of course, as you say, the big fight that's now breaking out is you've got a government in Ireland, which is facing an election coming up. You've got Rishi Sunak, obviously, with the local elections today, Thursday, when this is going out, and a general election coming towards him like a steam train. So nobody wants to give way on this. Ireland wants us to take these migrants back. Sunak obviously saying, no way, is that going to happen? Because he's got an eye on voters as well. But for me, Liam, what this is about immigration is out of control across Europe. The posturing sort of liberal progressive leaders are now really having to face up to the consequences of their policies, which do not have strong electoral support.
This is a fiendishly complex issue. It's a vexed question, as someone called Stanley Baldwin once said about the relationship between Britain and Ireland back in the 1930s. We could talk endlessly about the Brexit negotiations and the insistence of both London and Dublin that the land border between Northern Ireland and the Irish Republic remained free of checkpoints, because those checkpoints are evocative of the troubles when they were military checkpoints, often, you know, as I remember from childhood, rifle towers, searchlights, barbed wire, really quite aggressive. And no one wanted any kind of checkpoints on the Irish border. But now we're in a situation, of course, where the Irish government itself is under enormous pressure on immigration. And I can't tell you how the atmosphere in Ireland has changed in recent years. Just the last 2 or 3 years, you know, generally a very welcoming country, quite homogeneous, as you say, of obviously the emigration story is central to the Irish psyche, as is the kind of story of, as Irish people often say, you know, 1,000 years of oppression from the Brits. So often when Irish politicians are in trouble, they don the green jersey and start lashing out at, you know, the great enemy across the Irish Sea. And yet we know that for the most part, the sort of huge amount of affection, affinity, ties of blood and culture between the UK and Ireland are almost unique between any two countries in the world, between the actual people, if not the political classes. When you think, Alison, that the UK is a relatively small country in terms of population, and Ireland is a very, very small country in terms of population, you know, 4 or 5 million, depending on whether or not you treat it as an island or the Republic and the North separately with respect. And yet there are more flights between London and Dublin than there are between any two capital cities in the world. That's how closely linked our countries are by family and by commerce and by culture. And yet I fear, and I think Irish politicians are being really disingenuous here by blaming the UK, and a lot of people in government are trying not to say, you see, Rwanda is a disincentive because asylum seekers / economic migrants in the UK feel this is a real threat, so they're moving to Ireland. But they don't admit that, but they sort of secretly think that. The problem I think you've got is that this could lead to, you know, a real deterioration in relations post the Good Friday Agreement, when since then, for the most part, there have been squalls over Brexit, of course, relations have been so much better than they were in, you know, the early part of our lives, when basically military conflict in Northern Ireland was the nightly, you know, appearing on the tea time news that we both grew up with.
But we've had in the Telegraph a very good piece I can recommend by the excellent commentator Ruth Dudley Edwards. And she said what I think, Liam. She said, Ireland's made its bed and got a lie on it, casting around now. I mean, Varadkar's nowhere to be seen. He's showing a clean pair of heels, isn't he? And you know, I mean, we've followed this. There's growing anger amongst normal Irish people about unsustainable levels of immigration into a country that's struggling to house its own people. And I think that's going to be the story of the next few years. And in England, of course, we're seeing the last few days, aren't we? Oh, there's one failed asylum seeker co-pilot was paid £3,000 to voluntarily relocate to Rwanda. So the Tories now are pinning a lot of hopes on this Rwanda plan. I think we've actually had some asylum seekers being picked up in the last 24 hours, ready for deportation. But as we know from having spoken to both Suella Braverman and Robert Jenrick, they don't think this policy is going to work because they think that the European Court will interfere to stop them. And this has got to be my favourite fact of the week, Liam, is that our ever marvellous Home Office has mislaid of 5,700 illegal migrants that they were planning on deporting. Half of them have gone missing. Have you seen them, co-pilot?
Absolutely mad how people can just go missing in an advanced industrial society, isn't it? Very briefly, Alison, before we move on to our Planet Normal guest, let's just mention Rob Mendick's piece in The Telegraph, the two sides of the AstraZeneca vaccine, quote, miracle. Rob Mendick, of course, is The Telegraph's chief reporter, highly respected investigative journalist. But we have been talking, haven't we, on Planet Normal for a while about concerns about vaccines harming people in limited but significant numbers of cases. And now Rob's writing about court depositions where AstraZeneca itself acknowledges that there has been some damage to individuals, but the Treasury will pay any compensation because the government, of course, indemnified the big pharmaceutical companies, didn't they, in that rush to vaccines during lockdown?
Yes, they did. I don't think we did as much about it as we might have done, if I'm going to be brutally honest. It's a very, 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 very difficult subject. And for a long time, people were anxious about saying the wrong thing because it's a sort of a medical area. It's not just damage, Liam. Several people, younger people, have died. It's on their death certificate. So this isn't open to controversy now. Lisa Shaw, wonderful BBC radio presenter in the Northeast, she died within 10 days of having her first AstraZeneca jab, caused this clotting on the brain, which is one of the major side effects now, which is the subject of this litigation. We've got people like Alex Reed. He was aged just 28, healthy young man, given the AstraZeneca jab, if you wait for this, Liam, even though he was 28, because there was an error in his GP records, which wrongly classified him as morbidly obese. Absolute tragedy. Alex died aged 28. The bigger question here, Liam, and this is not something that the pharmaceutical company or indeed the government want to answer, is was it ever correct to roll out the COVID vaccine to younger, healthier groups. Everybody will remember the excellent Kate Bingham, who is our vaccine czar. Very early on, Kate Bingham said, this is not a universal vaccine. This is very specifically for older people and at-risk groups. Now, whether they bought so many that they felt they had to pass them on, we don't know. But I would say now, one of the things I feel the most strongly about the pandemic is it was never appropriate to give these. They're not vaccines, Liam. They're not vaccines. They're treatments. They're jabs. They don't prevent transmission and they don't prevent infection. That is not the definition of a vaccine. Now, these were given to younger people and amidst great controversy, the age limit or age range was lowered to take in teenagers and indeed children. There is an advert on the BBC News website today inviting people, this is the BBC covering the story, the NHS is inviting people to bring babies to have a COVID vaccine. That is madness. I mean, that is just utter wickedness. So for me, yes, it's excellent. The Telegraph is covering this, and I hope all the vaccine, profoundly vaccine damaged, is a relatively small number. But if it's your husband, your daughter, your child, it's terrible. And I think it is good. And I think the government now should settle and not make the same mistakes we've seen with the post office. But what I would like to see is the COVID inquiry answering the question in age groups where there was more risk to having the COVID vaccine than benefit. Should the government have rolled the vaccine out to people like Lisa Shaw and Alex, who are now dead?
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, marketers. Want a matchmaker to set you up with your perfect audience? Well, look no further. Get intimate right away with host-read sponsorships with Acast. Use Acast's self-serve ad platform to search and partner up with a podcaster or two from our network of more than 100,000 shows. Have them sing your praises in their own words. And get their listeners ready to be wooed into loyal customers. It's the ultimate loving endorsement. Book host-read sponsorships with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
Last week saw the death of Lord Field of Birkenhead, Frank Field, the widely admired Labour MP and former Welfare Reform Minister. I knew Frank Field for 30 years and wrote about his career and legacy in The Telegraph, link in the show notes to this episode. But someone who knew Frank for even longer than I did and who worked with him closely in government was Baroness Kate Hoey, herself a former Labour MP for Vauxhall in London. Both committed anti-poverty campaigners and both Labour Brexiteers, Kate and Frank were very good friends, Kate having served as Frank's parliamentary private secretary during his time in office. So we were delighted to invite Kate Hoey back onto the rocket to discuss not just Frank Field's legacy, but also the growing tension over recent weeks between the UK, her native Northern Ireland, and the Irish Republic. I started by asking Kate Hoey, though she wasn't surprised that Frank Field died after a long illness, was she still shocked?
Yes, it was expected. He had been so brave and so courageous, and so every time that I'd been to see him, you know, I was always amazed. And I actually, we joked about the fact that having, you know, that statement being read out in the Lords when everyone kind of assumed that he was just about to die, that he was still there. And we would joke about that. And I would actually tease him and say, there you are, you see, if you'd had, you know, euthanasia, you wouldn't be here anymore, Frank.
We should explain. So Frank's great friend, Molly Meacher in the Lords, said during an assisted dying debate, I think in 2021, my friend Lord Field of Birkenhead, who is ill and in a hospice, isn't here. But if he was here And then Molly Meacher in the Lords said that Frank was in favour of assisted dying, having changed his mind over the years. But of course, Frank was in a hospice, but he can be stubborn, as we both know. He hung around for a couple of years when everyone thought he'd already passed away.
He always said he was just sort of sussing out the hospice and having a look at it. Every time I would see him, he would, even up to the last time, he would actually physically get up and walk to the door. So it was a shock because I knew he'd fallen and I knew there was complications. But yes, for me, it was the end of a very, very long friendship, which I really did value.
How do you think Frank Field should be remembered? How do you think parliamentarians remember him?
We actually both started off our jobs, our first jobs, teaching at Southwark College. So when I came into Parliament, it was lovely to see him and to become friends. But I think he was of an era of politicians that we're not going to see again, and we're certainly not seeing it at the moment even, where someone who comes in really does put their principles ahead of anything else, party discipline. He wanted to change things, and he saw being a member of Parliament as a way to do that, having done some great work in, obviously, on poverty earlier in his previous job. He never was wanting to be an MP or a minister even, or a Secretary of State, you know, for the sort of trappings that supposedly brought with it. He did shun quite a lot of the periphery stuff that goes on in the Commons, the kind of getting together in bars at night. Frank wasn't that sort of person. He was too busy working. He worked very, very hard and had a very loyal staff who worked with him for many years. He obviously remembered the sort of legacy he has on welfare and the thinking that went into that. But I personally will just remember him as a very, very kind, loyal person who took time with anyone who he got to know. You know, he would literally stop in the street and talk to people, and, you know, they felt he understood them. He was just so different from any of the other MPs that I met and became friendly with over the years.
I can concur with that, Kate. To travel on a train with Frank, as I did quite a few times, was to witness just a string of people come up to him and say, thank you for everything that you do. He found it difficult to take praise, didn't he?
Very much so. He was actually quite reserved in his own way.
Very and shy in many ways. And he pushed himself forward because he needed to, in order to conduct his policy advocacy in the best way he knew how.
He could have made lots of changes and done things without having to actually socialise at all. He probably would. Although, having said that, and I think you'll know this too, Liam, I mean, he had a great sort of sense of humour, a dry sense of humour, and a laugh, which even in the chamber, sometimes when you'd laugh, you would hear him, because he had a very distinct laugh. He wasn't everything that a lot of people wanted to sort of paint him as, you know, priest-like. He was actually great, great, great fun.
What did Birkenhead mean to him, Kate? You and I know that he wants his ashes scattered in Birkenhead on a plot overlooking the Mersey. And yet he was a working-class boy from West London.
Yes, but I think, you know, spending 40 years as he did as the MP for Birkenhead, and he really knew every corner, every street, every shop, every business in that town. And he loved it. You know, every MP does get attached to where they're representing. I had 30 years in my area in Vauxhall, and I still, you know, can't go into it without feeling slightly emotional, you know, because you do get build up this rapport. But for 40 years, and for the fact that he had got there in a way, because he didn't come from the area almost, it made him even more determined that he was going to become a Birkenheader, if you could call it that. And of course, he's took the title in the Lords, which again showed his love for the area.
So had he prevailed, had he consolidated his power in New Labour, then perhaps, you know, millions of pensioners would now have their own pension pots and be benefiting from compound interest and investment returns, because he wanted didn't he, for every person to have their own individual pension pot that they pay into. He wanted to restore the contributory principle. He wanted to sharpen up incentives for people to get back into work. So maybe we'd have less of the sick note culture now, which ministers are still wrestling with, which he warned about for years. Given the extent of his writings on welfare, given the influence of those writings, given the way he was listened to in the House of Parliament, if not in Downing Street, given how many cabinet ministers, and you'll know this as well as me, before and since he was in office have used him as a kind of unofficial advisor, whichever their party they're from, and he would always give freely his best advice without going to the papers about it because he just wanted good outcomes. I've called him probably the most influential thinker on welfare in the UK since Beveridge. Do you think that's overstated?
No, I don't think it's overstated. And I think as time goes on, it will become even more recognised by people. He knew that it was going to be a long-term project, in a sense, what he was trying to do with welfare. But the problem with politics, and it's even more so these days with the fast speed of social media and 24-hour news coverage, that you can't, politicians and leaders aren't prepared to give time to anything because they see perhaps initially when something's announced, it isn't immediately popular or people don't understand how it long-term could help. And I think that's what happened on all of his. It was going to be too costly at the beginning and too much of a feeling, I think, that Blair thought, and certainly Gordon Brown, that this was not going to be something that the public would see as good. You know, I blame the leaders of political parties for never being confident enough to actually take risks with policies. And, you know, we see that all the time. But Frank knew that if we were going to change, really change the situation of so many people, then we had to look at the way the welfare system was acting as a barrier to people getting to work and people having a fruitful life.
Well, lots more will be written and spoken about Frank Field, Kate, not least by you, I'm sure, who knew him very, very well. But while you're here on Planet Normal, let me also ask you about another subject very, very close to your heart and indeed mine. And again, another subject that you and I have talked about over decades, really. And that's the island of Ireland, the relationship between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland. For all the progress of the Good Friday Agreement, for all the improvement in relations in recent years, which you and I have both welcomed very much, the relationship does now seem to be at certainly its most testing moment since the rows about Brexit, doesn't it? Since the so-called Irish backstop.
Yes, I think people thought, oh, everything's lovely now because our government had accepted the protocols, accepted Northern Ireland being sort of set apart. The issue now really is the fact that for some years, the Irish government wanting to look, you know, progressive and liberal and all of the things that people think when they think of migration has really operated almost an open border. And so they've been having thousands of illegal immigrants and legal people coming in. But the more recently what they've been doing, because there hasn't been the accommodation, and we saw that in Wicklow just last week, where the local community just had enough. They were not prepared to have 150 people dumped in more or less tents in their area.
And let's be clear, Wicklow, you know, it's not rural Ireland, is it? It's just south of Dublin. It's, you know, it's sort of the commuter belt.
No, exactly. But I mean, it's a bit of Wicklow where, you know, it's a small community and they got very angry. And of course, they were immediately accused, the government accused the people of being racist and being right-wing nationalists and all of that. Actually, they were just, a lot of them were just ordinary people with families and prams and out with the in a demonstration. And I think the government, having got an election coming, are absolutely terrified that they have to do something. So what do the Irish normally do when there's a problem? They blame the British. It's all because of the Rwanda bill. Now, the nonsense that the idea, I just don't accept it, that all these people have moved from Great Britain to Ireland, through Northern Ireland, because of the fear of being sent back to Rwanda. I just don't accept it. But nevertheless, I find it quite amusing. I shouldn't probably, but I do, because, you know, the Irish government was so keen to never have even a camera at the border. And, you know, because of wanting to protect the EU single market so that Northern Ireland has had to have a, you know, the UK has now put a border in their own country, which no other country in the world would do, you know, to please the Irish and to please the European Union and supposedly protect the Belfast Agreement and not have a border of any kind. Whereas the Belfast Agreement, as you know, Liam, only talked about military infrastructure. I mean, it is a frontier between the United Kingdom and an independent country. So, you know, I'm absolutely delighted that the Prime Minister actually did speak against what the Irish government was saying and sounded quite blunt. Now, hopefully that will stay. But it must be slightly concerning that after everything looked like there were the new Taoiseach was there and everything was started to be closer, that there is this rift which could get worse if the Irish government feel that it's helpful to them in their election coming up.
Leo Varadkar, of course, the former Taoiseach, stepped down in the wake of two referenda that went very badly wrong for the Irish establishment, trying to change the Irish constitution. And people resoundingly, in huge numbers, said no. And so Simon Harris replaced him as Taoiseach. Now, you're obviously from a unionist tradition in Northern Ireland, yet despite that, and I've known you for many, many years, you do wish the Republic of Ireland well. You do want good relations on the island of Ireland. And anyone that says you don't just doesn't know you. They're being disingenuous. And I'd absolutely stake my name and reputation on that, having talked to you over many, many years. So I ask you with real sincerity, Kate, what is the future of UK-Irish relations? I mean, could we even get to the point where the sacred common travel area, the idea that people from the Republic, as my family did, can come to the UK, people from the UK can come go to Ireland freely, we can vote in each other's countries. It's almost a unique closeness in the world. There's almost no two other sovereign countries who are that umbilically linked by blood, culture and history. Could the common travel area, which so many Irish people cherish, given how many come here to work, not digging the roads so much these days, but as accountants and media people and so on, could that be in jeopardy now?
I don't think it will be, provided we have a leadership in the Republic that actually starts to face up to reality and not sort of ideology about what's happened in the past. And I think we need some honesty too from Simon Harris. I was quite pleased when he came in and immediately said that, you know, pushing for a united Ireland was not a priority for his government. And I think that's what most people living in the Republic feel. Clearly, the relationships between our two countries are very, very close. And I knew that from my own constituency, where there were lots and lots of Irish second generation. And they had no anti-British feeling at all.
It's a bit confected, isn't it? Irish politicians, particularly Fine Gael politicians, who are traditionally, you know, less nationalistic, they feel they have to wear the green jersey and bash the Brits, particularly when Sinn Féin are about to win an election.
Well, I mean, Sinn Féin are certainly, although they've gone down a bit, they are certainly going to give both the two main parties in the Republic a real dilemma as to whether they offer them some kind of coalition, but if Sinn Féin don't win outright. And of course, then in Northern Ireland, we've got a Sinn Féin First Minister who actually was wanting back into Stormont, like they all were, to do great things for the health service. And all they seem to have done so far is she's come over to London and spoken at a huge anti-Israel, really, or pro-Gaza demonstration, which I think hasn't gone down very well with people in Northern Ireland, because, of course, we have quite historic links with Israel, with Herzog. And I think Sinn Féin are going to have to recognise that, you know, if the leader is trying to be bringing people together in Northern Ireland, speaking at that kind of rally is not actually helpful.
Because Michelle O'Neill, the First Minister of Northern Ireland, she was actually born in County Cork in the Republic.
Yes. Oh, I mean, I always slightly concerned for people who say, oh, must really find out a bit more about Northern Ireland, a bit more about the Republic. Because, I mean, you know, if you go into the whole history of it, it's pretty mind-blowing and difficult to get your head round if you don't know anything about it.
Kate Howie, brilliant to talk to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That was such a lovely, intimate interview, Liam, you and Kate, reminiscing about this wonderful man. And it really does come across. And I must say, co-pilot, that our normal joshing aside, you have written absolutely marvellously about Frank Field, your friend, a tremendous parliamentarian and humanitarian, and you've absolutely done him proud.
That's kind. I mean, you get to know a lot of people in our business, don't you, Alison? And inevitably, there are some people who you meet professionally and you write about who you do befriend. And I think as long as you're clear about that when you write about them, then I think that's completely fine as a journalist. I spent many hours with Kate Hoey and Frank Field when he was welfare reform minister, as a reporter for the FT at the time. And I think the reason I admired him and the reason we got on so well was that he was very much a cross-party person. He wasn't a tribal politician at all. He was all about the policies and the impact of policies on people's lives, hopefully improving them, making people's lives better. He was a policy guru, known across the world for his mastery of the subject of welfare reform, taxation, pension legislation. We just don't do clever very well in public life in Britain. Our political and media class eschews and rejects and is suspicious of people if they have genuine knowledge of their subject area. And this is a guy, and I can absolutely confirm this, I saw this with my own eyes, who before he was welfare reform minister and after he was welfare reform minister, pretty much every secretary of state for welfare, pension secretary, they'd always ask Frank what he thought, and he'd be their kind of unofficial advisor, whatever their party. And yet our own political system gave him less than 18 months in high office and only as Minister of State, never in the cabinet, despite the unrivaled knowledge and grip he had when it came to that subject. He wrote dozens and dozens of books and pamphlets on welfare, on taxation, on pensions. And that's why, you know, I've said over the last couple of weeks, and I mean this, I genuinely believe that he was the most important and influential thinker on British welfare policy since William Beveridge, who of course wrote the famous 1942 report, which launched the British welfare state, much mimicked across the world.
Well, I'm going to say now, you'll be embarrassed, but I'm going to say now that I think you, Liam Halligan, play that role now on housing. You are a housing guru, widely consulted by people across the political divide. And if we had you in Parliament exerting some influence, we wouldn't be in the middle of this dreadful housing crisis. Of course, I always strongly recommend Mr. Halligan's Home Truths. When he comes around to my house, he checks on the bookshelf to see that it's still there.
Still in suspiciously pristine condition, may I say.
I've given several away, not because I can't stand them, but because people who want to know about housing, I say, boy, have I got the book for you. But before we just move on to emails, Liam, let's just say that, of course, the local elections will be happening today, Thursday, and this is the last test of public opinion before the general election. So it is a bit of a litmus test on how much trouble Rishi Sunak is in. And we won't be able to tell, obviously, until later tonight, Thursday night, while local election results can't be mapped directly onto national ones. They are thought to provide a pretty accurate indication of party preference for around 80% of voters. And we know, don't we, Liam, that some Tory members will have been waiting for these results to decide whether to move against Rishi Sunak and install another leader.
Now on to our listener emails. Your messages sent to planetnormal@telegraph.co.uk. Please keep them coming. We love to read them and learn from you, the citizens of Planet Normal.
A great rush of emails about the SNP. Mark says, regarding Kate Forbes, other socially conservative separatists have been treated similarly, such as brother and sister Brian Suter and Anne Gloag. It would appear that you can dismiss Orthodox Christians as both a dispensable loony fringe and a hegemonic superpower to be expunged from the culture at the same time. Meanwhile, the Greens give us all Scots the disastrous outflow of playing God in God's apparent absence. Much as I reject separatism, says Mark, Scotland would be a better place if more of Kate Forbes's ilk were in office.
Very interesting. This is from Gemma Dear Alison and Liam, I just want to say again how brilliant your podcast is. Thank you, Gemma. And how much I look forward to it every week once I've dropped off my three kids at school. A dose of sanity in this increasingly mad world. I really enjoyed the interview with Suella Braverman, and it was reassuring to hear some common sense coming from a high-profile MP. However, if a Home Secretary can't enforce sensible immigration laws in this country, then I ask, what is the point of us voting? How can we all call ourselves a democracy? It seems like the blob, says Gemma, is running the country and they can do whatever they like. How depressing. Can you give me any hope? Perhaps you can both team up as Prime Minister and Chancellor and shake up the system. Thanks to you both for your continued hard work, which makes such a difference to so many of us. Gemma, how do you think we'd get on, Alison, as Prime Minister and Chancellor? Would we be Cameron and Osborne, always together, joined at the hip? Or would we be Brown and Blair?
Well, we wouldn't be like Theresa May and Philip Hammond, thank God, would we? I think we'd be like Thatcher and Lawson, wouldn't we? Do you think?
There you go. So we'd get on really well, and then I'd finally resign thinking that I'm cleverer than you.
I think that's pretty much where we are most weeks, isn't it?
Thank you, Gemma, for that wonderful email.
And this is from Denise, a Planet Normal superfan.
Plenty of them about.
Plenty of them about. I hope you're coming to the event, Denise. Dear Alison and Liam, says Denise, today's Telegraph front page headline reads, NHS declares sex is a biological fact. Do we laugh or cry? This is bears poop in the woods. Pope is a Catholic territory. I never thought I would live to see the day that medical experts felt they needed to state that such a basic fact of life ought to be broadcast. What vindication for you and all the others, J.K. Rowling, Maya Forstater, Graham Linehan, Sharon Davis, Julie Bindle. We can add so many to that list, can't we, Liam, including Telegraph's own Suzanne Moore, all incredibly brave.
Hugely brave.
And, of course, Rosie Duffield, absolutely astonishing.
Labour MP, abused by her own parliamentary colleagues.
Well, not only that, but this week, Sir Keir Starmer in an interview with Good Morning Britain, implying that he and Rosie were on very good terms and he'd seen her recently. That's not Rosie's version of account. So something to ask her at some point, Liam. But anyway, Denise says, yes, thanks to everyone who ran the gauntlet of woke trolling in the face of blatant ideological hysteria. It's a result of sorts, says Denise, but don't expect the ideologues to go quietly. Keep up the sterling work, Planet Normal.
This is a quick one from Tim, who wrote to us about his clever son, Jamie, struggling to get a place at a top Russell Group university. I wanted to update you, writes Tim, as to Jamie's progress. He achieved the high predicted grades and went through clearing to get a place at a leading northern university to study mathematics. He'll be starting in mid-September and is delighted. Congratulations, Jamie, from both myself and Alison. The interesting part of the process was that most of the universities Jamie originally applied to study computer science, had clearing places free, but only for international students. Because, of course, this is me, not Tim. International students get charged a lot more than domestic students. We have to keep pushing, finishes Tim, trying to secure a level playing field for British children. All the best to you and to Liam.
Well, you know, we could have a whole episode on that, but thanks, Tim, for telling us that. Let's be clear, that's an extremely high-achieving British child who wasn't eligible for clearing places in his own universities in his own country because those places were being kept free for high-paying foreign students, often with lesser grades, a subject to which we will return, no doubt, co-pilot.
And on that bombshell, that's it from Planet Normal for another week as we leave our Sanctuary of Sweet Reason, our flying refuge of reason views. Email of the week, it's my turn. Well, I think it has to go to Planet Normal superfan Gemma. So Gemma, email us at planetnormal@telegraph.co.uk. Put mug winner in the message heading and we'll send you in the post a Planet Normal mug.
Fantastic, Gemma. And please, everyone, don't forget to book your tickets for this wonderful live event to Mark. I can't believe we've had 200 episodes of you and me, honestly.
We only manage it because we hardly ever meet.
It's like Morecambe and Wise. How the hell did that happen? Yeah, anyway, please come because we're going to have a wonderful laugh. On the previous events, we've done it. it's absolute balm to the soul to be breathing the same air with people who share our views, not just our views, Liam. Often we've got slightly different views, but just an approach to life.
An approach to a disagreeing agreeably. That's what life should be about, in my view. And that's what our politics, our public life, our journalism so sorely lacks. And as we speed away from our beloved planet Normal and the madness of planet Earth comes back into view, thanks as ever to our producers, Isabel Bajard, Casso and Louise Wells. And thanks also to the Telegraph team under Debbie Stevens, helping us to get that Planet Normal event together on Wednesday, the 29th of May. Stay safe and in touch with us and with each other. Until next week, it's goodbye from me.
And it's goodbye from him.
Here's a question for the marketers listening. Want to find that perfect customer beyond the world of scrolling, swiping, and searching? Here's a secret to make sparks fly. Smooth talking with podcast ads. With Acast, you can reach millions of listeners who'll be hanging on your every word. On the train to work, in the gym, or waiting in line for coffee. Start up the conversation with podcast listeners anywhere and everywhere. And they're looking for love. 60% of listeners have a higher trust in brands they've met on podcasts compared to social. Get closer to your audience. Make podcast ads with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.